In late 1934, WAVE made national headlines once again. WAVE was called on by NBC to provide a hookup for the speech of General Smedley Butler, who was attending a World War I veterans convention in Louisville, and was asked to make a speech on their behalf over the network. General Butler was a character given to profanity, and General Butler proved this reputation even further during the making of this speech. Everything was going very well until the last 5 minutes of the program, and General Butler added his usual spice to the show as describing his troops marching through fields of cow manure. And after a few more choice words, the voice of a local WAVE announcer was heard saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, we regret this time we are unable to continue this program due to circumstances beyond our control. We shall return to this program to the network as soon as possible. At this time, you will be entertained by a brief musical interlude." Needless to say, according to Wilbur Hudson, this brief interlude lasted 5 minutes.
Smedley Butler. He's a Marine general, and when he got started, you had to be a little careful about be able to cut him off. And we finally had to cut him off. He was feeding NBC, and we got a little publicity out of that. Smedley got pretty mad. He wanted to bring the Marine Corps in and rid Louisville of that radio station.
Needless to say, telegrams poured into the station the next day regarding the incident and questioned the actions of radio station WAVE. George Patterson was known as an innovator who was exact to every detail, and to be employed at WAVE, you had to be one of the best. And naturally, Mr. Patterson was quick to develop the station's image. One such promotion was the man on the street.
Bert and I would go with a microphone to various locations, such as the Mary Anderson Theater, and the Rialto Theater, and then later, in order to vary the number of people that we were able to reach, that is, to talk to, the kinds of people, the old 7th Street Railroad Depot, down at 7th and Main, I guess it was, a day or two, a couple of days a week. When we did the man on the street, Bert and I, we usually would interview separately. I would have one, and then Bert would take the next one, and we would alternate. Sometimes we would do them together. We would ask any kind of question that came to mind. Sometimes a sort of trick question, such as, when summer begins, do the days begin to get longer or shorter? And the answer is they begin to get shorter, because from the first day of summer, that's the longest day. So after that, they're a little bit shorter each time. And the people used to wonder about that.
The Courier Journal wrote of Patterson and Blackwell's annex in the late 1930s, saying they spend a good deal of time asking ladies about the contents of the parcels they carry, which contain everything from underthangs, saucepans, and once even a defanged cobra in a birdcage. The Courier described them as the two who insist on starting up controversy. For instance, they began asking the question about long underwear one season, and the results proved that more people are old-fashioned than believed. This event was quickly put to rest when Burt Blackwell received a beautifully made miniature suit of red underwear. But clothing is not the only gifts received on the menu. The man on the street takes pies, sauce recipes, relishes, and just whatever they can get. And, of course, WAVE has nice prizes for the listeners, too.
Hello, everybody.
The cat got your tongue today, John?
No, the cat's got his tongue, though.
Little boy?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think so.
We've talked to him before,
yeah,
though.
He's here in the lobby of the Rialto Theater with everything to give away today.
Yes, we certainly have.
Who do you want to talk to?
Well, I don't care.
Let's talk to this lady. Will you come around,
all right,
please?
Why don't you step around there and tell us your name, please?
Miss Vaughn, 38th and River Park.
Mrs. Vaughn. And 38th River Park. Well, thank you, Miss Vaughn. Are you downtown shopping today?
Yes, more or less.
You bought anything?
Not yet.
The mid-30s brought a new era of broadcasting, and station WAVE, along with the help of NBC, covered it all.
To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
And you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do without the help and support of the woman I love.
The Hindenburg crash.
A ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather. And these giant flagships standing here, the American Airlines flagships, waiting to rise into all points in the United States when they get the ship moored. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship. The rain had splashed up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from...
The horse and the flag. Get it started. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast. And all the folks between the ships is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now. And the flame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. Oh, the humanity and all the...
The Lewis Snelling fight.
Right and left to the head, a left to the jaw, a right to the head. And Donovan is watching carefully. Lewis measured him, right to the body, a left up to the jaw, and Snelling is down. The count is 5, 6, 7, 8. The men are in the ring. The fight is over on a technical knockout. Max Snelling is beaten in one round.
The Kentucky Derby.
Heading for the far turn. War Admiral still on top and Pompoon still moving. Now in second spot. Followed by Heel Fly and Melodus moving fast around Billionaire, who's faltering. Reaping Reward now making his bid after pulling back. He's going to the outside. But strong on the lead is War Admiral going into the stretch. 3 lengths ahead of Pompoon, who's pulling away from Heel Fly for second. Now Reaping Reward takes aim on those ahead. He's driving, but they're too far ahead. War Admiral is going to win this derby. Jockey Kurtzinger has things all his way. Pompoon tries to make up ground, but he'll never make it. Reaping Reward is game, but the best he'll get is third. War Admiral crosses the finish line. This beautiful son of Manowar and Brushup is the 1937 Derby winner. Pompoon is second, Reaping Reward third, and Melodus fourth.
And great shows like Rudy Valley.
Hello, everybody. This is Rudy Valley and Company.
Father and I should fall in love with you. Do you think that you could love me too? Father and I should hold you and caress you.
And Ben Burney.
Here we are in good old Hollywood after a delightful engagement in Catalina. Boy, what a send-off they gave us when we left. The mayor bid us adieu. The chief of police bid us adieu. Everybody was there to see us off. I don't know. It always kind of seems to me that our closings are always so much bigger than our openings. Well, Catalina was really a very, very delightful experience. This is Ben Burney, the voice of experience, speaking. Elsa. And now the time has come to lend thine ears to au revoir, pleasant dreams. Au revoir, pleasant dreams. Think about it. When requesting your theme. Au revoir, a farm cheerio, a toodle doodle, a bit of a tweet tweet. God love you. And pleasant dreams.
The shows of NBC played an important role in the day-to-day routine of WAVE. Jimmy Durante, Will Rogers, Joe Pinner, Fred Allen's Town Hall Tonight, Ed Wynn, Larry Ross Showboat, and the Radio City Music Hall, the Happiness Boys, Eddie Cantor's Chase and Sandbernauer, Fibber McGee and Molly, Major Bowes and his Amateur Hours, and many other fine NBC programs were heard by the listeners of WAVE. WAVE was doing quite well, and so was the city recovering from the Depression. And then it all began in the winter of 1936. The Ohio Valley was hit with record rain and snow.
Call 1-800-743-COPY for Kinko's, where quality is affordable.
It was a period of terror in the greater Louisville area. The winter of 1937 had just begun. The Midwest was in the middle of a winter period when Mother Nature chose to unleash one of her most devastating phenomenons. They called it simply the 1937 flood. But there was nothing simple about it. People died, some as the direct result of the flood, others indirectly. Thousands of people were driven from their homes. Possessions that had taken a lifetime to accumulate were swept downriver like so much flotsam and jetsam on the high seas. Ironically, the city that had been born because of the peculiarities of the river became the victim of the mighty Ohio's geography, combined with an unusual set of meteorological circumstances.
I was a young corporal in command of the accident prevention section in the police department prior to the 1937 flood. At that time, we had about 418 police officers in the department as compared to more than 800 employees of today. And as the river kept rising and we were getting reports regularly from the U.S. engineers, we knew that we had a tremendous police job on our hands, and the department in very short order was put on 12-hour duty. And for approximately 2.5 weeks, the entire department was kept on these long hours, many times working 24 hours around the clock. The weather was quite bitter, and in many instances when the officers would go to their boats with outboard motors on them to take food and supplies to the different locations in the city where our refugees were, they would have to break ice from around the boat to get through. I recall that when it reached its peak, you could have gotten in a skiff with an outboard motor at the east end of Broadway and ridden that boat all the way to the hills of New Albany. I also recall that at nighttime, when the officers were patrolling the west end, they would wear leather gloves, and in riding in this skiff with the outboard motor, they would reach up overhead and hold on to the electrical line for the operation of the streetcars, the trolley wire. They did this so that they would stay in the center of the street, because if they got off to the side near the curbing, the outboard motor prop would ground on automobiles and put them out of commission, as well as tear the automobile up. One of our greatest tasks was perhaps in communication to the citizens. It was difficult to beat down rumor that would get around of great numbers of people that were drowning. And I recall that a story got out that on the pontoon bridge, which was made of whiskey barrels there in the east end on at Barrett Avenue, that they would stop all traffic coming across the pontoon bridge, that is pedestrian traffic, so that they could carry the hundreds of bodies to Cave Hill Cemetery to bury them, which of course was totally and completely untrue. These rumors were scotched by the mayor, the chief of police, and all the police officers by using every mode of communication that we could possibly think of.
In Louisville, as the floodwaters began to rise, city officials busied themselves calculating what water depths would attack the city and its residents. Estimates indicated that 2/3 of Louisville would be inundated. That would include about 3/4 of the homes in the Derby City. And the estimated crest of the river, an unbelievable 58 feet, a figure that seemed as remote as the very stars that filled the skies above the Kentuckiana region. After all, in a previous devastating flood in 1884, the crest had risen to a record-setting 46.7 feet, and much work had been done to prevent another disaster. The chief engineer of the City Water Commission went so far as to say that such flooding would surely bury the west end of town, an area about 12 miles square. When flooded, the river was expected to even change course and send a 6-mile current over the western half of town, resulting in untold millions in damages. In anticipation of the onslaught that was to come, the city began making preparations. Unfortunately, a near tragedy was already upon them. Nearly 20,000 people were stranded in and on flooded homes. Although monumental in proportion, the problem was as basic as one could imagine. How to move the people to safe ground, and once there, how to get them to relief centers. One bus company had parked a fleet of 20 vehicles on high ground. The keys were left inside. City officials, desperate to find conveyances of any kind, commandeered the vehicles and were able to transport the stranded to safer sites.
The authority came from City Hall. From his office in Washington, former Louisville Mayor Neville Miller talks about how the citizens of the city cooperated in their own way to prevent that authority from breaking down.
In various parts of town, you would have problems. And we'd have calls and messages that they needed boats and they needed food and needed this. And it was always really a problem. And we'd send people out there. We'd send businessmen. We'd send lawyers. We'd send truck drivers. And it would carry on. And all of a sudden, there would be a quietness. And we would not hear anymore from that part of town. And then we'd all take a glass of water and drink a toast to the new king who had been crowned. And those kings were very remarkable people. I remember one of the most attractive king was a Lutheran preacher who was the king of Barrett and Broadway. They laid out, as you recall, Broadway, the water hit Broadway, just about where Barrett Avenue, just past the underpass. And from there, all the way down to the river in Shawnee Park, was water. Well, this king laid out traffic lines. The big boats down the center, little boats down on each side. He also issued a traffic regulation that no boat, no big boat, should go over 6 miles an hour because it would create waves that might upset the little boats. Well, one of our heroes got a little enthusiastic and got too fast, and he started and he ran a wave that upset one of the little boats. And when that fella reported back to Barrett and Broadway, he was arrested, taken over and locked up in the garage and given water and bread for 6 hours.
A.B. Happy Chandler, who was the governor at that time, he and his staff were possessed with the keen insight to recognize that unusual dangers were bearing down on not only Louisville, but also the capital city of Frankfort.
I recall going on the radio from the prison, from the tower of the old state prison, which at that time was in the heart of Frankfort. And that was one of our immediate and most pressing problems because at that moment, the floodwaters had gotten into the penitentiary and the prisoners had retreated from the ground cells to the second tier. And I rode in through the front gate in a boat. And this is something that, of course, you would not forget. I stood up in the boat and with a horn that magnified my voice, I spoke to the prisoners. I told them that the flood was an act of God, that we could not prevent it, but that I felt responsible for their safety, and that if they would do as we directed, they of course had been without food for already then a couple of days. I told them that if they would just do as we suggested and be of good cheer and not make trouble, that we would immediately take steps to move them out of the prison, and that if I were successful in the efforts to move them out of the prison, that I'd make them a solemn promise that I'd never put them back. Because I said, I think you may well understand that we have a right, because of the fact that you violated our laws, to incarcerate you in the penitentiary, but we haven't got any right to put you in a place of danger where your lives are threatened. But I want to plead with you. I'm your governor, and I'm here, and I feel responsible for your safety. So we set to work immediately and built an escape hatch from the sixth or seventh story of one of those buildings over the prison wall. And, of course, by the next morning, the prisoners, of course, just, I'll never forget, they just stood at the windows with their gaze fixed. And, of course, they were frightened. Nobody knew how much more water would come. And, of course, there were a great many stories that circulated around the town and around the Commonwealth that they'd had a riot there and that they'd killed each other and that There were prisoners dead, and others had escaped. I waited in the penitentiary grounds and all around it, and had some friends go with me with a stick, expecting to find bodies before the water went down, because I was certain that after the water went down, that they would be there based on the stories that we'd heard. But we walked through the water and with these sticks, and let the story be told and retold, that we got those prisoners out the next day and put a camp high up on the hill.
With martial law in effect, there were some sobering measures taken. In order to protect life and property, the city's director of safety issued orders on Monday, January 25th. Those orders specified that police were to shoot any person on the spot who was found looting. Second, businesses and industrial concerns were permitted to have officers and employees stay overnight. These people were permitted to have weapons, and they were given authority to use them on anyone found looting or even attempting to enter their property. In addition, food, clothing, gasoline, and other critically needed articles were confiscated from whatever sources could be mustered. To ensure that the goods were turned over to proper authorities, the confiscation had to be conducted by police in uniform. Also, saloons had to remain closed. Food stores that sold beer could remain open but could only sell food. And profiteering was a major threat. Police were given authority to immediately investigate profiteering in food, and if there was a finding of guilt, the director of safety could order the confiscation of all of their goods. As one looks at this natural disaster, one wonders how anyone could gain from being an observer of such devastation. But the sightseers came. Police had their hands full just trying to keep them from interfering with the aid to victims process. Visitors, along with sightseers, were asked simply to stay away from the flooded areas. They were asked to do everything that they could to make the situation better, yet do nothing that could make it worse. By Sunday, January 24th, 4/5 of the city of Jeffersonville was underwater. Already, 4,000 people were driven from their homes. Relief agencies, backed by military units, were being pushed to the limits by trying to cope with the homeless. In the 24-hour period prior to that fateful Sunday, the Coast Guard calculated that 500 people had been rescued from housetops and other high points throughout Clark County. Also on that Sunday, from the Rose Hill Elementary School building near the end of the municipal bridge, the cries of newborn babies could be heard. Yes, three newcomers were introduced to life in the relief shelter on that day.
On that inauguration night in Washington, William James of New Albany was in Indianapolis as a state senator. He rushed home to see what he could do.
I came out of Indianapolis that night at approximately midnight, arrived in Louisville sometime around 4 o'clock in the morning, and got a taxi cab to bring me to New Albany. That's when my full-time activity in the flood started. From then on until in February, I was in New Albany all the time. It started out for me with about an 18-hour a day work, but many of the men worked longer than I did. A lot of them worked 20 hours without rest. I recall some of the people who worked long hours, Mr. Darniel being one of them, and our sheriff then worked long hours, and the people in general responded, and I don't know that we ever asked any of them anything that they didn't do. As the flood increased, there were numerous people came from over the state and from other states, some of them bringing their own boats with them to help in the evacuation. And these men all volunteered their services and their equipment. I don't know that any of them was paid. Some of them had damages restored by the Red Cross. But that was not their prime motive. They came here to help us out. They did a wonderful job. We had a lot of trucks, boat pickups, tractor trailers, trolling staff of that nature employed, and Merle Denny, who was operating a transfer company at that time, did a tremendous job with his equipment in trying to move furniture from homes that we expected to be inundated. We had some bad luck with the moving of furniture and other personal property, as we did not know the elevations of all the intersections in the city of New Albany, and consequently, not knowing that, and not knowing how high the water would get, we did store a lot of furniture and personal belongings in buildings that later became inundated.
In the midst of all the confusion, frustration, fear, and desperation, quietly came the staff of Wave Radio. Throughout the ordeal, day and night, the personnel remained on the air. The staff was not engaged in continually broadcasting the news, as one would expect during such a major crisis, but rather, they relayed messages. Messages that seemed inane in content, but so valuable in the saving of a life.
Like Nat King Cole, Johnny Mathis, The Platters. Hear all your original favorites on Wave 970, WAVG, Louisville.
Via satellite, this is the Unistar Radio Network.
At one point, the power went out. The Wave Radio staff was stranded on the top floor of the 15-story Brown Hotel, 3 feet of water lapping at the cornerstone.
The lights went out in the hotel, and we could no longer use the elevators, of course. They had patrols, a fire patrol of whoever was the appointed guests, a fire patrol on each. They would walk along the each floor to see whether there was any fire, which there never was, thank goodness. And then after a short while, Wilbur Hudson, Nate Lord arranged for a transmitter out on the down in the parking lot right outside the Brown Hotel, and Wilbur Hudson ran a line up the outside of the Brown Hotel to our place, to the studios on the 15th floor. And we got back on the air.
Found an old generator down in Southern Kentucky, 100 kilowatts, and brought it up there on a flatbed and put it right behind the Brown Hotel and hooked it up. And the 100 kilowatt was considerably more than we needed to run that 1 kilowatt transmitter. So we tapped into the hotel, some of their circuits, and gave them power so that they could have a light or two on each floor in the hallways. There was a lot of good food 15 floors below us in the bluegrass room and in the English Grill, but you had to walk down 15 floors to get it.
It was nearly 3 weeks before the waters receded back into the original channel and regular power was resumed in the area. In the final analysis for the communications industry, it proved that the staff at Wave Radio was able to do in a crisis situation what radio does best: reach the people directly and as rapidly as possible. And in the 1937 flood, they attained the highest plateaus of professionalism. To those who were there, we today render a salute for a job well done. For Wave 970, I'm Gil Dougherty.
It's Kinko's 2.5 cent copy sale, where we'll take your originals and give you an incredible value. Call 1-800-743-COPY for Kinko's, where quality is affordable.
In 1938, Wave was instrumental in getting the city to protect itself from another flood with a proposed flood wall. And in January 1938, Wave participated in a flood appreciation night. Performers from WAVE, WBAP, WLS, WLW, WSM, and many other stations performed. Cousin Emmy from WHAS was there, and also Pappy Clayton McMitchin and the Georgia Wildcats performed representing station WAVE. The program was sponsored by the Courier-Journal and Louisville Times. In 1938, station WAVE was on the lead again when Wilbur Hudson and Bernie Hopeman designed the city's first mobile broadcast unit on wheels. Let's listen to this special report on cruising and traffic, broadcast in early 1939.
We present at this time, Cruising in Traffic, a special safety feature of WAVE. Our shortwave transmitter, W9XSE, in the mobile unit is awaiting to take the signal. At the wheel is Bob Grace, and at the microphone is Officer Jerry Kopp, Superintendent of Traffic Education. In the cause of safety in Louisville, we take you cruising in traffic.
Good evening, my friends. Again, I'd like to have you join me in this great game of traffic as we're going to cruise through Louisville's very busy streets this evening. Before we start cruising, I want to remind you that so far this month, we have had one fatality. However, that counts on last month's record because the person was injured during December and he died before the 15th of this month, counting it on last year's record. And so far this year, really, we have no fatalities. Now, as we're cruising this evening, we're turning to go south onto 4th Street, just turning off of Jefferson Street, and there's not much traffic going south on 4th Street, but quite a number of cars that are coming north on 4th Street, probably all of the line halfway out to Walnut Street as we're pulling up here to Liberty. And here's a pedestrian crossing over through the crosswalk, doing a good job because he is walking with the signal, and now the signal has changed from amber to green, and now the cars are starting to move out on this green light. And as you notice, driving through 4th Street now, all of the Christmas decorations are coming down, and it does look a little dead after the way it had looked during the past few weeks. But now we're cruising along here, and hardly no traffic at all, but up ahead is a pedestrian who is jaywalking, crossing the street, and taking his own sweet time with that attitude of, well, I dare you to strike me. And I know sometimes we'd like to roll up behind a pedestrian like that and give them a little bump, but we can't afford to take chances like that because one slight bump might mean a serious injury. So we've got to accept our responsibilities and try to stay out of traffic accidents. Now we just crossed over Walnut Street. We had the green signal, and here's a car that turned onto Walnut Street, and rather onto 4th Street, and I want to look at the speedometer, and this cab that's in front of us is cruising along at a speed less than 10 miles an hour, and that's a violation of the law for a taxi cab or any kind of an automobile to cruise along at a speed of less than 10 miles an hour on 4th Street, and this cab certainly is taking his own sweet time cruising along here, and I'm sure the way the driver is watching the sidewalk, he is trying to watch for some fare. Of course, we've got to watch the sidewalk as well as the street, but we should not pay too much attention to that sidewalk because we're likely to run over someone who is already out in the street. Now we're pulling up behind the line of traffic, and we'll have to stop here nearing Chestnut Street, and the traffic up in front of us is stopping now, starting to move out, and here's a boy coming north off 4th Street riding a bicycle, does not have a headlight on that bicycle, and a car just getting ready to pull from the curb over here. The driver did a good job by turning on his lights before he started to even pull out from the curb. I'm sure that driver won't ever be caught driving that automobile without his headlight turned on. Again, we pulled up near Chestnut Street, about the third car in this line of traffic, and we've had to stop now for the red traffic signal. There's a streetcar going west on Chestnut, pulled up to 4th Street to load and unload his passengers, and there are a few people getting on and off the streetcar, and now a few of them crossing. Here's some people who are coming across Chestnut Street here on the red light. They're taking a chance. In order to catch the streetcar, they're taking a chance with their life by walking through a red traffic signal, and now the traffic signal is changing amber, and now it's green, and the driver up ahead, while the driver of this taxi cab that I was talking about, he was cruising through 4th Street at a speed less than 10 miles an hour. Nevertheless, he did give a right, that is, give a turn signal to allow the motorist behind to know that he was going to make a right turn, and then allow the pedestrians in the crosswalk to have the right of way. That was a very courteous act, and I'm sure that driver probably overlooked the fact that he was driving slower than 10 miles an hour while going through 4th Street. And now we're cruising along again, and traffic is moving along very slowly now, not because traffic is cruising, but because there's a heavy line of traffic out here between Chestnut and Broadway, and there's pedestrians walking along on the sidewalk, and a number of people standing here watching a man paint a window, and I'm sure they're very interested in the whole thing. I hope that they're just as interested in this game of traffic when they get out here on the street. And here's a man stepping around behind a car that's pulling into the curb and jaywalking across the street, and he just barely missed getting hit by a car that was coming along. He didn't look either way when he stepped out into the street. He was willing to take that kind of a chance. Now we're moving along very slowly out 4th Street. A few cars coming north on 4th Street, and probably more of them going south now, and pedestrians, all just numbers of them up here on the sidewalk walking along. Not very many of them, but just as I said, not very many of them. Another pedestrian jaywalked across the street, did not cross in the crosswalk. All he had to do was to walk about 25 feet farther north, and he could have crossed the street in the crosswalk, but he wasn't willing to do that. And just now, two more of them crossing the street jaywalking, and they're stepping around the back of cars here, and there's a car getting ready to back up here a little bit, and had they been just a little bit later, they might have been struck with this car that was going to do a little backing so that he could pull out into this line of traffic. And this car is sitting out a little bit too far from the curb, a car that's parked here, parked too far out from the curb. Remember, when parking an automobile, you must keep your car as close to the curb as you possibly can, and not be any farther than 6 inches from the curb at any time. Remember that it's very necessary when parking a car to leave the rest of the roadway open for through traffic. We're pulling up to Broadway now, and we're about the fourth car in this line of traffic, and we're waiting on the red traffic signal. I noticed quite a number of cars going west on Broadway, one or two of them going east, and the signal is still holding red for us, and the cars up in front of us are still standing still. Here's pedestrians standing over here waiting for the streetcar, and over on the other side, numbers of them walking along, watching. And here's a driver making a right turn to go north on 4th Street. Here comes another car making a right turn. Oh, I didn't think he had the lights on, but he had his dim lights on. I couldn't see him when he first made his turn. And now see one going along. It's perfectly all right in the Central Traffic District to drive along with your dim light. However, outside of the Central Traffic District, you must have your bright light turned on. We're getting ready to make a right turn to go east on Broadway, and here's pedestrians crossing the street in the crosswalk. They're doing a pretty good job looking both ways, watching traffic, not taking any chances at all, and now we're cruising along east on Broadway, and here's a car pulling up the curb over here on our right, and he's pulling just as close to that curb as he possibly can get, and I'm sure that that driver's car won't be involved in any accident while it's parked there by anyone who is driving just a little bit too close to those parked cars. And here's a man pulled up here in the safety zone lane. He's pulled over near the right curb, letting a passenger out, and now he's starting to move on as the traffic signal changes, and here's a woman who is caught out here in the crosswalk, and the driver up in front is not giving this passenger, this pedestrian, the right of way. They're coming right on through. They're making that woman stand out there in the street. Remember, whenever a pedestrian starts to cross the street and they're in that crosswalk when the light changes, then the thing to do is to allow that pedestrian to get safely across the path of your car over onto the sidewalk before you start to move your car. And now the driver up ahead, he's driving along out in the center lane, driving along at a speed of about 8 miles an hour. He should be over in the extreme right driving lane if he's going to drive that slow, because traffic moves faster than that, and certainly in order to make these lights here, since they are synchronized on Broadway, in order to make them, you've got to drive at a speed from around 22 miles an hour, and this driver is holding up all traffic just because he's in no hurry at all. He's driving right out in the center lane of traffic, a lane that is for through traffic, and now he's getting worse than ever. He's getting over into the extreme left driving lane out there in the streetcar track, going to hold up more traffic by driving along at a very slow rate of speed. I'm afraid that driver in that car has his mind on his girl rather than on his driving. Now we're pulling up to 1st Street here. The traffic signal is red. Here's a car going south on 1st Street. However, there's no car to go north on 1st Street any farther than Broadway, because 1st Street is a one-way street for southbound traffic only. Here's a car over on my right here, sitting out here just a little bit too far across the white line. The driver should be back just a little bit across that, back on this side of the white line. But probably by the time we get up to Brook Street, the traffic signal will have changed to green for us. I don't know whether it's coming on. The amber hasn't reached yet, but here's a pedestrian, two pedestrians crossing against the red traffic signal, and now the amber light is on, and we're moving on out across Brook Street without any trouble at all. Remember, in order to make these traffic signals here on Broadway, if you drive along at a speed of about 22 miles an hour, 20 to 22, you'll find that you will make these signals without having to stop for an amber or a red light at any time. And now there's this driver up ahead here. It's switched over from the slow lane. He's driving along at a speed of about 20 miles an hour, 22 miles an hour. He switched over into the center lane. That's a proper lane to be in if you're going to drive at that speed. If you want to drive at a slow rate of speed, then get over in the extreme right driving lane. But do not drive slow right out here in these two lanes. And here's a car that's parked diagonal to the curb right out here on Broadway, blocking one whole lane of traffic. The driver of that car has just pulled the front end of his car up to the curb, blocking a complete lane of traffic just because he was so discourteous as to park in that manner. Whenever you see the cars that are parked parallel to the curb, then you too park your car parallel to that curb. Don't leave the back end of the car sticking out so as to block any of that oncoming traffic. Just crossed over Preston Street now, and there's very little traffic up ahead of us, riding alongside of the streetcar now. We're passing it up, and we're riding right in this center lane here. That's usually the best lane to ride in on Broadway, the one that weaves just around the outside of the safety zone, because if the streetcar stops, then you can get on through without any trouble at all. The one thing to do when on Broadway is to pick one of these lanes and stay in that lane until you get ready to turn off. Then when you find that you're going to turn off of Broadway, it's a good idea to get over to the right lane. The right thing to do is get on the right lane for a right turn, a left lane for the left turn. And just as we were coming along between Clay and Hancock Street here, a pedestrian was taking a sweet time getting across Broadway, just walking across in the middle of a block. Had he walked to the intersection, it would have been easier for the drivers to see that pedestrian, and it would also have been much safer for the pedestrian to have crossed the street. Now we're getting over to the extreme left driving lane, and the traffic signal is now changing from red to green at Clay Street, and we're going right on through up here at Clay Street without any trouble at all. And no traffic going north or south on Clay Street, none of them holding up there, and very little cars coming west on Broadway, and just about three or four of them that are going east. Very little traffic out here tonight, and I'm sure that we won't have a very high accident experience because of heavy traffic tonight. Now here we are crossing one of Louisville's worst intersections, Shelby and Broadway. This intersection has accounted for several bad accidents during 1938, and so far one bad accident during 1939. So the thing we want to do while watching through these bad intersections, be very careful driving through them, because you can't tell at any time when someone is likely to run through a red light or make a turn, improper turn. You're likely to be involved in a very serious accident. So the thing to do, someone coming along Broadway at any time, be very, very careful, because there are more accidents occur on Broadway than any other streets we have. Last year in Louisville, during 1938, here, right here in Louisville, there were 5 fatalities to occur on Broadway alone. And certainly that's entirely too many, and all because some of our drivers or pedestrians were willing to take a few unnecessary chances. Now we're up here at Barrett and Broadway. We have the green traffic signal going on through without any interruption at all. Traffic is now swinging over into the center lane. You know, that is where the lanes end, right there at Barrett and Broadway. They're now swinging over into the center lane. Everybody being very careful swinging out here. Traffic is moving along very moderately tonight. Very few cars are taking any chances at all, other than probably a few improper turns or something of that sort. But none of them are attempting to save any time by driving faster than the law permits. I believe the majority of our drivers are getting to realize that you can't save time by driving faster than the law permits. There's entirely too much congestion, entirely too many traffic signals, traffic signs, and markings that will slow you down. So the thing to do is to drive along according to the speed limit, and I'm sure that you will get there just as soon and quite a bit safer. So now we're getting up here on top of the hill at Broadway, just about a square from Baxter and Broadway, and the traffic signal is green. I don't think it'll be green by the time we get there, though, and all the amber light is on, and probably by the time we get up to Baxter and Broadway, the red signal will be off. And here's traffic coming west now, and there's 1-2 cars, and both of them driving along at a very moderate rate of speed. Well, I thought the one car was coming on down and went on down Baxter Avenue, did not come on down Broadway. Very little traffic out here tonight, and not very much to talk about. I wonder, Bob, if you have any kind of a question that you'd like to ask me tonight, and this is very little traffic out here this evening. Would you have any question you'd like to ask me?
I can't think of any right now, Jerry.
Well, I thought maybe you could help me out here a few minutes, because there wasn't very much out here this evening to talk about. I thought maybe you might have a little question, but nevertheless, we're up here at Baxter and Broadway now, and here is a pedestrian stepping out here on the traffic light here, coming across on the red light. Should have waited until the green light came on, and Bob tells me that my time is up. So please, friends, we'll be listening again next Tuesday evening at 5:30. We'll be back at that time. Here you are, Bob.
Thank you, Officer Cobb. We return you now from the mobile unit to the studios.
Cruising in Traffic has been a safety feature program of WAVE, brought to you through the kind cooperation of the Accident Prevention Section of the Bureau of Traffic of the City of Louisville. Another program in this safety education series will be brought to you at a later date. This is WAVE in Louisville.
Bob Crosby and the orchestra looping the loop on a history of wave. And now let's listen to a record by Ella Fitzgerald from 1939 called Undecided. Fitzgerald, along with the Chipwell Orchestra and Undecided, a history of Wave 970. Hitler had been steadily preparing the German people for battle, and in 1939 sent his troops to invade Poland. In 1939, the German Luftwaffe attacked Great Britain, and Germany began its attacks on Belgium and France. And in late 1939, Germany attacked Russia. Americans who were practicing isolationism of Europe's affairs were steadily becoming aware of the German threat to the United States. The United States began its gradual building of military supplies, and in 1939, WAVE prided itself in breaking the news as it happened, and in many cases beat NBC in reporting it. George Patterson created a special feature entitled Behind the News. Let's listen to that program, which aired in late 1939.
From Germany, Italy, France, Albania, Czechoslovakia, Spain, and Great Britain comes news. News that fairly sizzles with the heat of impending war.
news that grows more vital to the United States every day. And from the United States, from Washington, New York, Chicago, and 100 other cities of the nation, comes news. News that tells of economic change, of elections and Supreme Court appointments, of happy events and disasters. To bring you this news, while it is still humming over the wires and through the ether, has become a major part of the broadcasting activities of WAVE. Tonight, we take you behind the scenes for a glimpse of the machinery that turns every time a bullet hums, every time a statesman speaks, every time news is made.
We're speaking to you from the newsroom of WAVE, and here are assembled the tickers and teletype machines that pour an ever-ending stream of news reports into the studio from the four corners of the world. Behind these machines lies the far-flung empire of the great news-gathering agency. It's my pleasure at this time to interview Mr. H. Lee McEwen, news editor and head of the WAVE newsroom. Well, Mac, I'm going to put you on the spot tonight. Do you mind?
Not at all, Bert.
Well, Mac, will you tell us something about your experience in newspaper and radio news broadcasting?
Well, Bert, I've been in the newspaper game back all my life. I started out as a cub reporter on the old Cincinnati Post.
Is that so?
That's many more years than I'd like to recall right at the present time. But I might give you an inkling. Oh, McIntyre. You remember Mac? The
yes, indeed. Everyone in Louisville used to read his column.
Wonderful writer. Mac was my first city editor. Gave me my first assignment as a cub reporter on the old Cincinnati Post.
Well, I suppose you knew him well then, didn't you?
Very well. Very dear friend of mine.
Well, tell us something about your work on the local newspapers and about the Press Association work.
Well, I stayed on the Post first for a good many years as a reporter doing police, city hall, courthouse, politics, just about everything that was to be done there. Finally, Roy Howard, he's now head of the Skip Howard League of Newspapers and head of the United Press, transferred me to Washington to work for the United Press. I spent several years in Washington. I was in the Senate Press Gallery for a long while. I was in the State War and Navy Department and at the White House.
How many years did you spend with the syndicate?
Well, I was with the syndicate later. That came about 4 years with the syndicate.
How about the presidents? Have you interviewed any of the presidents or gotten news stories from them?
All of them, from the time of Woodrow Wilson. Several of the presidents since I knew before he became president. Warren Harding, President Roosevelt, for instance.
Well, he was Secretary of the Navy, probably, in the days you were in Washington, wasn't he?
No, he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. That was... Daniels was Secretary of the Navy at that time.
What was Mr. Roosevelt like in those days?
He was one of the finest men I ever met in my life. He was well-liked among the newspaper men. And, well, to give you some idea of the boy, we used to engage in a little African golf every afternoon in the press room.
I suppose he handled the reporters in those days just like he does today. Is that...
Yes, he'd come in every afternoon. Come in every afternoon and shoot dice.
Well, do you remember Teddy Roosevelt, his predecessor?
Yes, I knew Teddy. I didn't work in Washington during his reign, though, as the president.
Well, how about the newspaper men of Teddy Roosevelt's day, like Lincoln Steffens, the famous muckraker, and Richard Harding Davis? Were you familiar with those? Did you know those guys?
I have met them, yes. I've met Davis. They used to be a little hangout for the newspaper men in New York. The hole in the wall, they call it.
Is that so?
Cafe in the World Building. You could go in there any time of the day and meet practically all the famous newspaper men, war correspondents, and artists, I believe, in the country.
Well, Mac, what about the World War days? Are any incidents of the World War days very vivid to you now, especially when the war broke? I suppose it's a great deal different. The news is different now than in those days.
Yes, it's a whole lot different now. Of course, the World War broke very suddenly on us. That is, as compared to the way things are shaping up in Europe today. We've had warnings. We've been predicting war for 2 years, it seems like to me, every day.
Well, what was the reaction in Washington when war was declared among the newspaper men?
Well, it's very hard to describe. It's very hard to tell you that. Exactly the reaction among the newspaper men. We expected it. We all had the insight and knew what was going on. Of course, we were not permitted to print or write anything of what we knew until we got permission from the White House and the State Department.
Well, now, we always like to ask the newspaper man what's his most unusual story. That is, the story seems most unusual to him that he had to cover. What's yours, Max?
Well, there's two stories that stand out in my career. One of them was the story of America's entrance into the World War. I had the pleasure, but I can look back on it now with a great deal of pleasure, writing America's entrance into the World War, Woodrow Wilson's address to Congress. I also later wrote the story telling of the arrival of American troops in France. That was rather unusual, Bert.
Why, how's that, Max?
We got a cablegram in the United Press office in New York of two words, American landing.
And you had to write it from that, huh?
I wrote about 3,500, 4,000-word story from the two words.
Well, that's what makes a newspaper man, Max. Well, how about your most unusual story?
Well, I think I can safely say that hinges on a bank robbery in Cincinnati. We had a young fellow named Oakes up there, a bank robbery. In 1 hour, he held up three banks, made his escape, came back to the scene of the crime, surrounded in the house, and captured and shot, killed at it.
In what space of time?
Within an hour. Held up three banks and got $45,000. And incidentally, the police recovered all but except for $500 of that money.
When did that happen?
Bert, I couldn't tell you the exact year. They piled up, too.
Well, have you done any news gathering outside of the country, Mac? Have you ever been in any other country?
Yes, I've did a lot of it. Practically every place that you can name. In press association work, you never know where you're going to be from 1 minute to the next.
There's a man working with INS now. We got some fine stories on the lead wire, H.R. Knickerbocker. You know him?
Very well. Knickerbocker used to room with me in New York. I consider Knickerbocker today one of the outstanding correspondents in the business.
Well, thank you very much, Mac, for your interview, and we're very happy to have you here with us at WAVE. And now we're going to take you to Studio C.
This is George Patterson in Studio C, from which flow the regular news reports over WAVE. In the event of a major crisis of any sort, be it disaster, war, or threat of war, our regular program is broken, and the news is brought to you frequently before the major networks have cleared their own channels for special news. Our phrase, keep tuned to WAVE for the latest headlines, is no idle statement. Radio is the fastest messenger in the world today, and WAVE prides itself on using its facilities to the fullest degree at all times. That is why we say, keep tuned to WAVE for the latest headlines.
From early morning until our usual sign-off time, 1 a.m., the news is edited and broadcast at regular intervals. Today's news brought these headlines.
This is Bill Brundy speaking. At 8 o'clock, Monday through Saturday, we bring you 15 minutes of news. At 8 o'clock this morning, we brought you this headline as it came off the wire. 500 warships massed in Mediterranean. The story. More than 500 warships, one of the greatest arrays of rival naval strength in modern history, were massing today in the Mediterranean as the German Armada neared Spanish waters for a spring maneuver. The fighting ships were those of Europe's four leading powers, Great Britain, France, Germany, and Italy.
Bill Bond speaking. At 10:45 every morning, we bring you your second regularly scheduled newscast. This morning, we brought you this headline. England speeds war plans but rejects conscription. An index to the most important story in our news broadcast at 10:45. The story. A vastly increased British war potential was announced by Prime Minister Chamberlain in the House of Commons today. The British Prime Minister assured the House that England was taking all necessary military measures, but the British statesman rejected moves toward conscription.
This is Harry Lucan speaking. Our next newscast reaches you every day at 12:45. Sponsored by Fels Naftas Soap Chips. On today's broadcast, I brought you this headline. Federal mediator enters coal strike parley. The story, federal labor conciliator James F. Dewey has been accepted as the mediator by the negotiators seeking a wage adjustment in the soft coal industry. While the coal operators and representatives of the miners bicker over wage and hour clauses in the new coal contract, more than 320,000 miners in the Appalachian coal fields are idle. Dewey's entrance into the negotiations followed closely the appeal by New York's mayor that President Roosevelt take a hand in settling the controversy between operators and miners. While operators and miners bicker over the items of the new working agreement, New York's coal supply has diminished to the point where the industrial life of the nation's greatest city is endangered. This is Bert Blackwell.
At 3:55 every afternoon, we bring you 5 minutes of news. The lead story of those I broadcast at that period today carry this headline. Colonel Lindbergh recalled to active duty with Air Corps Reserve. That was a thrilling story and revealed one of the reasons the famous American aviator, the Lone Eagle, was recalled from his self-imposed exile in Europe. And here's the story, as you may recall. Colonel Charles Lindbergh has just been called to active duty with the United States Army Air Corps Reserve. In addition to his other duties, the famed transatlantic flyer will make a confidential report on American aviation facilities for the Chief of the Air Corps. Colonel Lindbergh will enter service tomorrow. He will be assigned to duty in the office of the Chief of the United States Air Corps. There was more to that story, and later developments were broadcast over this station as the story was unfolded in Washington and rushed to our newsroom over leaf wire.
Bill Brundage again. Sports news comes to you first over WAVE, every weekday afternoon at 5:15.
One of the most interesting stories to break on the sports front today concerned the New York Yankees. You and I and every sports fan the country over have been discussing the possibilities of any other American League club replacing the Yanks as pennant winners this year. While most baseball fans seem to think the Boston Red Sox will be the strongest contender for that top berth. Today, though, a new angle presented itself. What did the Yanks themselves think about the situation? Well, several of them were interviewed, and here's what they had to say. Joe Gordon thinks about the Boston Red Sox. Joe DiMaggio, the Red Sox also. We quote Lefty Gomez, Boston's going to be the tough club. The dissenters are in the case were Red Rolf and Wes Farrell. They think Detroit is the team to watch, with their powerhouse trio, York, Gerringer, and Greenberg. Not a one of these players even intimated that the Yanks have a chance of losing their crown this year. In their opinion, the teams mentioned will furnish the world champions the greatest amount of opposition in the coming season.
Bill Sherman speaking. At 5:45 each evening, we bring you tomorrow's history while it is still the news of today. Sponsored by the Morris Plan Bank. At 5:45 today, I presented a complete roundup of the day's news, reviewing the highlights of the news from the four corners of the world and adding latest news bulletins as they came from our newsroom. Today, I was able to tell you more details of the recalling of Colonel Lindbergh to active duty with the Air Corps. And in addition, reported this headline. Italy orders mobilization of additional fighting men. The story under that headline revealed that Premier Mussolini had ordered the immediate mobilization of a new Army Reservist class. Men of the class of 1913 were called to the colors in a sudden move which increased Italy's armed forces well beyond the 1 million mark. The order for additional mobilization came despite an official statement last week which specifically declared that no more men would be called up, and I now quote that statement, except under exceptional circumstances.
And here is a news story which has just come to me from our newsroom. The transatlantic luxury liner Paris is threatened with complete destruction by a fire raging uncontrolled through its interior and upper decks. Art treasures valued at more than $750,000 and destined for exhibition at the French exhibit of the New York World's Fair had been stored aboard the passenger ship. And these two faced destruction by the raging inferno. From 6 p.m. until closing time, WAVE stands ready to interrupt its other programs to bring you news of consequence. And, if conditions warrant, our transmitter remains open for 24 hours. Can you imagine how different this picture would be in any country other than the United States? Nowhere else does the news reach you promptly, completely, and best of all, uncensored. For in American radio, you, the listeners, are the only censors. And so it is that from 6 o'clock in the morning until our sign-off time at 1 a.m., our newsroom offers you consistent, full coverage of the news as it happens. We have taken this means of acquainting the public with the facts behind the statement. Keep tuned to WAVE for the latest headlines.
This has been a special feature broadcast from our studios in the Brown Hotel. WAVE, Louisville.
This has been a message of your Kentucky Division of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service.
In December 1939, WAVE celebrated his seventh birthday. Little did anyone know what lay in store. Emperor Hirohito, Mussolini, and Hitler were spreading their aggressions all over the world. Although not directly involved in the war effort, the United States loaned millions of dollars in equipment to the British and Chinese forces fighting the Axis. This program was called the Lend-Lease Program. In 1940, France fell, and Hitler himself visited Paris.
What General Vagon had called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this with their fighting power.
Great Britain, in order to pay back the United States, agreed to allow the United States to install bases in England.
We meet and the angels sing. The angels sing the sweetest song I ever heard.
From the year of 1939, Benny Goodman and the orchestra and the angels sing. We hope you're enjoying A History of Wave Radio, and we will have more of the special following news from the U.S. Radio Network.
It's Kentucky Network Sports Call, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 on Wave 970, WAVG, Louisville.